Good afternoon. Welcome to UK Call News. It is Monday, the 18th of March, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Joining me today, Patrick Henningsen. Welcome to the programme, Patrick, for 21st Century Wire.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be with you.
Well, we're going to get straight on. I'm going to apologise straight away for using the BBC to source this, but this was breaking news this morning and just caught it before we came on air, so wanted to include it. So a new shooting. Whether it could be described as a mass shooting, not sure just yet, Patrick, but don't seem to be too many details. This is in Utrecht in the Netherlands. One person dead as someone opens fire on a tram. So the BBC saying a gunman has opened fire on a tram in Utrecht. Several people have been injured, one feared to have died. The shooting took place at 10:45 local time this morning. The gunman's still at large, so schools, mosques, all kinds of places being closed down, security locked down at the moment. Counter-terrorism police saying it appears to be a terrorist attack. So, of course, this follows on from the Christchurch attack in New Zealand. And it looks like we're ramping up a right wing at the moment.
Certainly looks like that, Mike. Those are the indications in terms of the political reaction coming out from the fallout of the Christchurch shooting in New Zealand. Certainly does indicate that.
Well, let's have a look at what Theresa May, what her message was regarding Christchurch.
I have been in contact this morning with Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern to express the UK's deepest condolences at the horrifying terrorist attack that took place at two mosques in Christchurch. To target Muslims as they were attending their place of worship is despicable, and our thoughts and prayers are with the people of New Zealand, with the families and friends of those who have died in these attacks, and with all those who have been injured.
Now, Patrick, there's a certain amount of hypocrisy in that statement. And, you know, we offer all our condolences to everybody affected by what happened in New Zealand. But for the West, for a Western leader or for the West to say that it's despicable that Muslims are being attacked in this way in a mosque, while at the same time, for example, we continue to supply arms to Saudi Arabia and other places where they're who are attacking Yemen, where there are lots of people dying in mosques on a regular basis. There does seem to be a bit of a hypocrisy in this.
Yeah, and also I might add the United States bombing mosques, which has also happened recently in Syria. It seems though that if Muslims die on Western soil, this is treated with tremendous emotion and outrage in the Western media, and the perpetrator is called a terrorist. But if U.S. or coalition military forces kill thousands of Muslims or kill innocent people in a wedding party in Pakistan with a drone, that's not terrorism.
No.
We're told. And also, in some cases, they'll get medals of honor like Madeleine Albright. Anyway, we can discuss this more at length in the extra time segment, Mike.
Yes, so for members, we will be discussing this more after the program. That will be available on 21 Wire and also in UK Column shortly after the news program today. Now, in the meantime, getting back to New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, has announced detailed, well, what are being described as detailed gun law reforms. So she's saying that the cabinet in New Zealand has agreed this within 72 hours, that there's some details to be worked out. So it's going to take a few more days before the actual legislation appears. But nonetheless, the agreement has been made to proceed with gun control laws in New Zealand. No particular details other than this ultimately means, she said, that within 10 days of this horrific act of terrorism, we will have announced reforms which will, I believe, make our community safer. The response to this continues. The gun control is clearly one part of it in New Zealand. The other part of it are the calls for more censorship on social media.
Sure. I think on the gun control issue, it's important to note that she did announce that our gun laws will change right after the attack, and of course, just roughly 72 hours later, yes, they have changed that quickly. The gunman or the terrorist in this case, Brenton Tarrant, had a gun license, had a firearm license, which was acquired in New Zealand in 2017. So he was legally carrying the firearms. However, she was talking about banning semi-automatic weapons across the board. I might add that New Zealand has very stringent measures in place in terms of gun regulation already. So this is really a case of tightening the screws on top of what is already there. It's much more regulated, let's say, than in the United States.
Okay, let's move on to Brexit then. And the news that, well, it looks like Theresa May is garnering some more support. It's still a bit touch and go for her, but if this sure isn't any more than a charade, which, of course, we believe it is to a certain degree. David Davis announced that he is backing Theresa May. This is in a letter that was written. And he's basically saying, he didn't literally say this, or at least not publicly anyway, oh, shut up, Boris, because Boris is sticking sticking with the we shouldn't pass Theresa's deal at the moment. So it's Boris versus the rest, it seems. So several Tory MPs who have up until this point been against Theresa's deal have written a letter. The letter said, we voted against the deal in the first meaningful vote, but we now recognise that there is an increasing risk that holding out for a perfect deal, we could end up losing Brexit altogether. Some of us voted for the deal in the second meaningful vote because we felt the departure date on 29th of March would be lost. That has regrettably become reality. Now the UK is faced with the prospect of a long extension of Article 50. It says Brexit is at risk, therefore we urge colleagues who, like us, wish to deliver Brexit to vote for the deal and ensure we leave the EU as soon as possible. Is this having any effect? Well, here is Jacob Rees-Mogg, and he was speaking on LBC this morning and saying no deal is better than a bad deal, but a bad deal is better than remaining in the European Union. Mrs. May's deal, however bad it is, means we're legally outside the European Union. So he was saying that he hasn't decided yet exactly which way he's going to vote. But this certainly seems to indicate he's tending towards voting for the deal. Should it come back tomorrow night for a third meaningful vote? So perhaps it will be third time lucky for Theresa May.
Yes, well, the whip is working, maybe. She's got enough there.
She may have enough. I mean, there's still some question over whether the DUP is going to vote with her. And
That might require some incentive.
There has been rumor of another £1 billion bung towards the DUP. We wait to see with interest. The bottom line here is, of course, Theresa May's deal is not what is implied in the letter. It is not fulfilling the spirit of Brexit. Will we be legally outside the European Union, as Jacob Rees-Mogg suggests? Perhaps, but only for as long as it takes to negotiate the future relationship, and then we'd be right back in again. So really, the Tories should not be trusted on this, I think most people are appreciating that by now.
So it's Brexit without the exit.
Absolutely.
It's the best of both worlds.
The best of both worlds.
Exactly, almost exactly as David Cameron laid out in his white paper in February 2016 when he called for the referendum, correct?
Absolutely.
Interesting, because didn't you say that at the time?
I believe I did.
Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting.
Anyway, everybody would be glad to know that, we're not now going to leave on the 29th, perhaps as expected. But on the 30th, Exercise Joint Warrior begins. So this is really good stuff. This is Belgium, Canada, Denmark, Estonia, France, Germany, Italy, Latvia, Lithuania, Netherlands, Norway, Spain, UK and the United States all taking part in this exercise. This is a UK-run exercise, 10,300 armed forces personnel, that's 6,500 at sea, 3,000 on land, 800 in the air. They say that although it's run by the UK, the Joint Warrior is closely aligned to NATO training aims and is included in the NATO exercise programme. So we might look at this as a NATO exercise. It's taking place in various locations across the UK. And Gavin Williamson had this to say because he was very excited about it. He said the UK military is a partner of choice for its major international allies and a resolute force for peace around the world. I believe he said it with a straight face, but I have to admit it's difficult to have a straight face reading that out.
Keeping the home fires burning. Gav?
Absolutely. Well, look, sticking with NATO and so on, of course, Russia is the target these days. And, well, most people remember this little video clip. This is the Kerch Strait. And, of course, this happened, I think it was...
I think you want to call this a planned provocation on the part of the Ukraine. That's all the evidence points that was the case.
Well, that was the case, I believe. But that doesn't matter because the EU, Australia, Canada, the United States and the UK have imposed sanctions on individuals for their role in this particular...
I'll just knock this on the head, right? Ukrainian boats have passed through the Kerch Straits before this and gone through all the necessary protocols. So it's the argument that Russia is somehow impeding international maritime travel falls flat on its face just on that point alone. The second point is these boats were, some of them were carrying weapons and they were not following protocol or heeding the harbor master's calls. So they were dealt with according to procedure. Unfortunately, if you're not complying with procedure in this case, there might be an altercation. That's the risk that anybody, whether they're going through U.S. territorial waters in sensitive areas or in Europe as well. So,
well, that may be the case, but it really doesn't matter because according to Jeremy Hunt here, today the U.K. and international partners sent an unequivocal message to Russia that their attack on Ukrainian vessels in the Kerch Strait and Black Sea last year was absolutely unacceptable. So there you go. Well, not to be outdone by the British government and those other governments, NATO is also on the case because, of course, this is the anniversary of the force used against Ukraine to illegally and illegitimately annex Crimea. And NATO's saying today this violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity is a serious breach of international law and a major challenge to Euro-Atlantic security. We strongly condemn this act. NATO calls on Russia to bring an immediate end to all violations and abuses in illegally annexed Crimea, to release Ukrainian political prisoners and hostages, and to grant international monitoring organizations access to Crimea. Right. Well, so while the pressure is coming on from the West onto Russia, Russia, on the other hand, is trying to hold out some kind of olive leaf. And well, this is the Russian ambassador to NATO, who a couple of days ago saying we take all the necessary reciprocal and symmetrical measures in order to ensure balance in the INF there. So this is the Intermediate Nuclear Missile Treaty. However, we do not plan to deploy our missiles, including in the European part of the country, that's of Russia, as long as there is no U.S. facilities of this kind in Europe. Now, what are the chances of that?
So he's asking for essentially some sort of reciprocity.
Sure.
A quid pro quo, in a way trying to get negotiations moving a little bit by making an offer, an initial offer, and the response has been, it seems to be a stonewall.
Well, the response seems to be more sanctions.
And we're not moving our missiles.
No.
So, again, we're not any further forward. So this is very bad for diplomacy, I think.
Well, it is. But let's not end there because, of course, attributing blame on the basis of no evidence is the name of the game these days. And this is the OPCW, who are delighted about the fact they have received money from the Australian government for the team of people that they're building who will be empowered to attribute blame for future chemical weapons attacks. So the government of Australia is contributing this money towards the Trust Fund for Syria missions for the formation and operation of the OPCW team to identify perpetrators of chemical attacks in the Syrian Arab Republic. And this team was created pursuant to the decision, this is their words, on addressing the threat from chemical weapons use adopted by the Conference of State Parties in the fourth special session in June 2018. So how did this come about? Well, back in June 2018, in the early part of June, Alistair Burt, the International Development Minister, said the international community should come together and strengthen the OPCW's capability to prevent the further use of chemical weapons, including by attributing responsibility for these heinous crimes. And this followed a report from the OPCW on the use of chemical weapons in the town of Litmina in northern Syria. And there was an accusation of sarin used at that point. So that was in the first part of June. By the second part of June, the 26th of June, the OPCW had decided that they were going to hold this special meeting in line with the release of the Duma report. And so they held this event, and Boris Johnson took part in it. And he said that attributing responsibility for an attack is clearly part of the OPCW's technical remit, requiring no change to the Chemical Weapons Convention. Well, the Russians didn't agree with that, and many others didn't agree with that as well. But the Russians said this: the UK is trying to turn the OPCW from a body focused on providing technical assistance to member states in executing the requirements of the CWC into a quasi-prosecutorial policing and forensic medical structure. So as I say, this is the latest tranche of money for this. They're assembling a team of experts. And other countries as well contributing to that. We've got Switzerland, money from Norway, and money from Denmark already gone to it, a couple of other countries as well, but there's more money on its way. Now, alongside this, then, the OPCW is being heavily funded to build a new future centre for chemistry and technology, and they're receiving money from Algeria. Well, they've had contributions from Algeria, Belgium, Canada, Estonia, France, Italy, Japan, Netherlands, Poland, Korea, Slovakia, Spain, and the UK. So they're seeing that their remit is going to expand in the coming weeks and months. And I have to wonder, Patrick, bearing in mind that the Syrian war is ramping down at this point, why the OPCW would be arguing, and in fact their member states arguing, that there's an expanded remit for this organization.
Yeah, like there's more people who are wanting to use chemical weapons now than ever before. It's totally counterintuitive to reality and logic, but you can see the circular logic that's being employed here in statements by Boris Johnson, and then sort of the reaction to the veto or to the objection by Russia, for instance, will be always from the West. Oh, of course Russia's not wanting to give this power to the OPCW because they are guilty of using chemical weapons. Why else would they object? And the same with Syria, and not taking into account the possibility that the case might actually be trumped up, the evidence might be non-existent or bogus, and the fact that Syria and Russia have a legitimate argument that isn't calculated in there. Instead, they employ circular logic, which is backed up by quite a lot of propaganda in the West.
Well, indeed. And, as I say, the main driver for this was the Duma incident. And as we covered on last week's program, of course, the final Duma report is out. And what a load of nonsense it is as well. And I just chose one of the quotes from Peter Hitchens here. Personally, I think the OPCW's inclusion in its report of so-called open source materials, such as films purporting to show events in Duma, is an absurdity. They rightly say that they don't attach great weight to them, but they would be better to leave them in annexes. Well, that's true, but we'll come on to more on the issue of open source material in just shortly. But, you know, this was one of the key points, Patrick, but this apparently, this report, or at the time, an earlier version of it, used to drive for the ability for the OPCW to attribute blame. And this has to be seen in the context of the broader rapid response mechanism in the G7, which is all about attribution of blame on the basis of no particular evidence and having a common narrative between the G7 countries to make sure that no matter what happens in the future, what evidence finally turns up, it doesn't really matter because the narrative was set, and that's then becomes the truth.
And a common narrative that's synced up, Mike, that's streamlined between governments, between the multilateral institutions or regulatory bodies like the OPCW, and last but not least, and most importantly, a common narrative that's also recognized by those previous parties and the mainstream media.
Yeah.
And you have complete agreement across those three sectors, and that is your fusion doctrine. That is your rapid response mechanism.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, but the ICC?
The ICC, the International Criminal Court. Now, this is an interesting organization, and how does this feed into what we just talked about? Well, this is the judicial body, the super tribunal, if you will. And here it is. If you've had the pleasure of ever being going to The Hague and seeing this is in all its glory, that is the ICC. It looks like it was built on a reclaimed landfill. In fact, I think it's on the site of an old military base and firing range there in The Hague. And there it is, one of the most depressing places on the planet, and for good reason. So initially it was founded in 1998, and this is important, as part of the Rome Statute at the UN Conference of Rome. And it's famous for many high-profile cases, but this was meant to be a super tribunal for member states to legislate on behalf of humanity. That's the principle behind it. And but the slight problem is that the U.S., China, and Russia did not sign on to the ICC, and herein lies the source of many problems with this organization. And this is meant to be essentially a tool capable of judging criminals at the end of war. So the idea would be if, you know, institutions have been obliterated or things, society hasn't been rebuilt, and this would be a tool to come in with the international community and sort of help to rebuild in its institutions on top of a justice verdict, if you will.
Okay,
so there's the ICC. Now, what's important is the ICC has been given some new powers, okay? And when it gives new powers, these tend to override the individual nation states. So here's the European Union trying to push this month, has passed a resolution here. The European Parliament urges the EU to adopt a legislation like the Magnitsky Act. So this is along the lines of the global Magnitsky, to be able to grab anybody in the world on anti-corruption charges and then sanction them. So this is essentially the started in America under the built on the top of Bill Browder's fraud, which is the Magnitsky Act and the whole story. And they're still using Sergei Magnitsky here as the poster person for this campaign, the Russian accountant, Bill Browder's accountant, who died while in custody in Russia. And this is how they built the whole story. So the Euro-Magnitsky, so this was the resolution on March 14th, calls on the European Council, comprising of representatives of all 28 member states, to swiftly establish an autonomous, flexible, and reactive EU-wide sanctions regime that would allow for the targeting of any individual, any state, and non-state actor, and other entities responsible or involved in grave human rights violations. And who decides what's a human rights violation? Well, it's the International Criminal Court is one of those bodies mm-hmm. that will give that verdict. So you can see how these pieces fit together. And this is to override the national sovereignty of all nation states, especially the ones being targeted. So this is, now here's the rub. This is where things get interesting. So the ICC had trained its sights from a few years ago, but specifically in 2017, against the United States for potential war crimes in Afghanistan. Okay, so this is the ICC using new powers. They've just received expanded powers to also target states rather than individuals. Okay, so this is the expansion of the ICC's remit. So, and here's Mike Pompeo just the other day regarding the Senate vote on the end of U.S. support for the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. And so he's basically, this has become one of the issues that they can snag the United States on. And the U.S. is threatening to sanction members of the ICC if they go ahead with any prosecutions or attack the United States for their involvement in this war or Afghanistan or any of them. So they're now threatening the ICC. So this is nothing new in terms of U.S. aggression against the ICC as a institution, but it's getting more aggressive. They're ramping it up. And here is the sterile environment. This is one of the courtrooms here. And lo and behold, Myanmar is potentially in the dock for the treatment of the Rohingyas. And this is the important one. Bashar al-Assad, a complaint was lodged by a member of the Muslim Brotherhood a few years ago, and that was regarding human rights violations. Okay, so they're wanting to try Bashar al-Assad. Again, Syria's not signed on. They're not a member. Neither is Myanmar. Neither is the United States. So, and then here's another case here, of course, the U.S. versus Afghanistan. So this is a new sort of phase. This will test whether the ICC will have any teeth, any legitimacy going forward. So we're reaching an impasse right now, Mike.
And then finally, UN Security Council veto power?
Well, this is the important part. So all of these need to go through the UN Security Council. Yeah. So the ICC can do what it likes in terms of producing a verdict or a case, but then it does go through the UN Security Council. However, the ICC has now acquired autonomy. Okay, so they're able to go around this inconvenience of the potential of, in 2014, something came up with the U.S. and the Gulf put forward some sort of introduction, something through the ICC, and this was effectively vetoed. And so that sort of started this process, I think, from 2014 to really acquire this level of autonomy.
Well, so, and indeed, if you listen to what various politicians in Britain have been saying over the last couple of years with respect to the ability for the OPCW to attribute blame, the ability for the G7 to have a rapid response, attribution of blame and a common narrative, everything that's at the back of that is the complaint about Russia and China and their veto in the UN Security Council. And this ICC development seems to be the same. Correct me if you think I'm wrong here, Patrick, but I think we have a lot to thank Russia and China for, because they have effectively scuppered quite a lot of the Western agenda in terms of intervention over the last decade or so.
But you can see where the lines are drawing internationally between the non-aligned countries, Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, and others, and Africa. We can thank Africa for quite a lot, too, because in 2016, Burundi basically announced it wanted to withdraw from the Rome Statute, because it accused the ICC of being a kind of a colonial institution. In fact, if you look at who's been convicted by the ICC, it's only black African individuals. I don't know if there's any white Europeans, definitely no Americans.
Well, only Milosevic and these types.
Maybe Milosevic was their one sort of trophy.
Yeah.
But that accusation keeps coming up over and over. And if you go to the ICC and you go through their lobby, and you can see they boast about their triumphs, and it's basically their convictions. And there's only a handful of them, and they're all African. Mm. It's kind of, and I think Gaddafi also was dragged into that scenario as well. So, again, an African. So it's kind of obvious. This is kind of like a neo-colonial institution, and Africans see it, but for some reason we don't see it in Europe. I can't imagine why.
Can't imagine why, yes. So. Okay, well, let's head over to Trump land then. And, this is a bit embarrassing, really, Patrick, for CNN and for Christopher Steele, because Christopher Steele, of course, is the former MI6 agent who wrote the dossier against Trump, which was commissioned and paid for by the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. And of course, that fed into the Justice Department's Russiagate investigation and, well, what do we call it? Charade, perhaps. But anyway, it turns out that a deposition that Christopher Steele made, part of it has been released publicly. And in it, he admits that he used a defunct part of the CNN website. This was called iReport, and this was user-generated news, so open-source user-generated news. It was run by citizen journalists. It wasn't edited. It wasn't fact-checked. It wasn't screened before being published. And it seems that Christopher Steele has admitted in evidence that he gave in a deposition that he used that as the main source, or as the source for the main allegations from his dossier. So this is a little bit embarrassing. So Trump, naturally enough, yesterday was tweeting out, report Christopher Steele backed up his Democrat and cooked and crooked Hillary paid for fake and unverified dossier with information he got from send-in watchers of low ratings CNN. This is the info that got us the witch hunt. But the point is, Patrick, is not that, that this is user-generated. Nobody really knows who the users are. People are hiding behind sock puppet accounts in most cases. If you were wanting to set up some kind of deep state operation against Donald Trump, it would be a very easy thing, would it not? And this is purely speculative, I admit, but it would be an easy thing to do if you're a little team of a privatized intelligence organization like Christopher Steele's. Simply push this information into CNN first, mm-hmm. and then cite that in your dossier, and you've actually produced the whole story. You know, you're not actually relying on open source information. You're pushing that information in yourself. It'd be an easy little operation to run, wouldn't it?
Sure. And I think anybody who's suggesting that Christopher Steele was just surfing the internet and he happened to find something he liked on CNN iNews, Mike, I think you're incredibly naive. I think you're exactly right. I would be now looking at who posted that information. And there are open source investigation organizations. There's quite a few of them around that are getting quite a lot of press. And they employ lots of people and research juniors and ex-gamers and people like that. Certainly they could be have people working on the case, putting up so-called open source information on an open platform like that, but it, as part of that network. So absolutely they created their evidence. They used CNN to launder it. And so in this case, they've gotten caught out. And it's much worse than this. There's a number of fabrications in the Steele dossier, but a number of media outlets are sticking to it and arguing that somehow it's been validated, but it actually hasn't. It's a fraudulent document. It's been pushed and it's been elevated by CNN, by BuzzFeed initially, and then now it's taken as gospel.
And by John McCain.
Well, this has come out as well as a result of the opening, unsealing of these documents. So John McCain, Senator John McCain, was actually running point, distributing the Steele dossier to various members of the media. There he is, one of the most divisive members of the U.S. Senate of all time, in fact. And unfortunately, John McCain is still making headlines after death. So McCain was pushing this around. What's important here, Mike, is that it made its way to the State Department via John McCain, into the hands of Victoria Nuland, and then on to the FBI. Okay, that's that side of things. We haven't got into the other side of things, which was also what triggered the investigation to begin with in the FBI and the FISA warrants to spy on members of the Trump transition team. And that's also going to be coming out in the coming days and weeks. George Papadopoulos, as well as will be releasing information on that. His book is very good, by the way. I encourage people to go look at George Papadopoulos' book. But basically, Mueller investigation, Russiagate crashing and burning right now, and then now unsealing all of the FBI's investigations and testimonies and finding out now what the real story is. This is going to be hugely damaging for the Democratic Party going into the 2020 election cycle. I dare say that this will be used to total effect. Donald Trump will squeeze every bit of juice out of this.
Yes.
In the coming year and a half.
Okay, well, let's head back to Syria again and more chemical weapons, and this time Ghouta.
Well, this is a great interview. You can go and read this up at 21stCenturyWire.com. And this was a decorated Belgian war reporter who was captured as a result of being caught. He initially was embedded with the Free Syrian Army as they were becoming kind of being taken over by al-Nusra and al-Qaeda affiliates. But he was taken hostage for 5 months. And he just did this interview with Syrian News, which we've syndicated on 21stCenturyWire.com. And he's basically said quite incredible things, Mike. And he has also paid the price professionally for coming out. You could call him a whistleblower of sorts. And his name is Pierre Pinichian de Prata. And he is the editor-in-chief of the Maghreb and Orient Courier. And he said Obama had promised he would attack Syria if the government used gas. This was the red line. And it was a time when the rebels were losing the war. If the rebels did that, it was to try to drag the United States into the conflict, hoping to reverse their military situation. And he goes on to add on this as well, the Syrian government had no interest in using the gas. He's talking about sarin or chlorine. This is Ghouta in 2013. And strategically, it was useless, and that could only ruin his image, Bashar al-Assad, on the international level with the risk of an American attack. These are all common sense analytical points that we've made many times. The only difference is this is a decorated war reporter. He said even his Italian colleague, who is also held prisoner with him, has preferred to keep quiet on this issue. I never asked him directly why, because I would not like to embarrass him. But I'm sure it was his editor-in-chief who told him not to talk about that. And he also added, I should have kept shut up too. And it is certain that my professional career has suffered a lot because of this revelation. So it made an interesting comment here, which we put on the top in the slug, which is, what is the point of being a war reporter if it is not to tell the truth? It's a very fundamental question. And so he's now said to, this is to the whole media, he's saying one word for the Western media. It's time for all those who are wrong about Syria, about what was really happening since 2011, to recognize their errors and restore truth for the readers and listeners. Unfortunately, the Western press is not as free as it claims. And I doubt that such a questioning will ever take place. So that is this reporter from Belgium. So this is a really important interview. He had dozens of media interviews scheduled. They were all canceled after he gave this interview to Syria News. So he's been basically shut out of all of the radio stations. These are based on comments as well he made on RTL. This is a Belgian broadcast radio network. But so he will, in the short term, pay the price, Mike, for telling the truth. And by the way, he was captured, and this is also gleaned from conversations of eavesdropping when he was listening to terrorist and rebel operatives talking, and also talking with them directly, because he was able to communicate with them during his 5 months of captivity. But all those details are in this interview.
Okay. Well, sticking more on this subject, in a sense, the National Archives have been releasing documents, and they've been releasing them for quite some time. But it's a new batch of documents here about an organization called the Information Research Department. This is the Foreign Office's so-called secret propaganda unit during the Cold War. So you can go and search the National Archives. There's a whole bunch of stuff on the Information Research Department. This was all about putting fake news stories into the mainstream media during the Cold War, Patrick. So for 30 years, the Foreign Office, through the IRD, fed information to journalists, had its own news agencies. So 2,000 files have been transferred to the National Archives since the start of 2019. There are actually quite a number of files that were released to the archives from before 2019 as well. So at the height of its activity, which would have been in the 1960s, 400 to 600 people employed to do this. They were funded by what was described as a secret vote, where government money was given to them, not subject to parliamentary scrutiny. And I've got to say, Patrick, that if it was happening then, it must be happening today.
It does sound familiar, doesn't it?
It does sound familiar. And so I'm just going to bring this up again, because here is Mark Sedwill, who, of course, is the National Security Advisor and also head of the Civil Service and also head of the Cabinet Office. He, being head of the National Security Council, also head of the Cabinet Office, is effectively in charge of what goes on in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. And the Foreign and Commonwealth Office has a counter-disinformation and media development program, which, as we've mentioned many times, headed up by Andy Price, and pumping money into things like the Integrity Initiative. And I have to say that the model seems to be very, very similar to what they were doing in the 1960s, 70s and 80s, or certainly 60s and 70s anyway, as the Information Research Department. Is this any different in practice or in principle? I don't think so.
And I might add, Mike, that the person who is heading up the Integrity Initiative, Chris Donnelly, is himself from the Cold War, very active in the Cold War era. So he himself is a Cold Warrior. So that's interesting how these two issues dovetail.
Absolutely. Now, finally, I just want to mention this. Deemed consent for organ donations in the UK is now real. The Organ Donation Deemed Consent Bill received royal assent on Friday. So this has now become an Act of Parliament. It is legislation that now means that you're presumed to be agreeing to donating your organs in the event of you passing away with, you know, that consent is presumed.
Having an unfortunate accident.
Well, exactly. There are some exclusions. So children under 18 are excluded from this. People who lack the mental capacity to understand the changes for a period before their death are excluded from this. And people who did not live in England for at least 12 months before their death are excluded. And there's still a bit of consultation going on about whether certain organs should be excluded from the opt-out system. So basically, from now on, if you don't want your organs to be donated, you have to opt out. And you have to register that. I just want to remind everybody of this article on the UK Colour website, No Time to Die. This is very relevant to this issue. If you haven't read that yet, please do so. We'd be interested in your thoughts. Okay, well, look, that brings us to the end for today. Patrick, we're going to do a UK Column News Extra right now, and that will be available on UK Column forums and also on 21wire.tv later on for members. Otherwise, we will see you at the same time, 1 p.m. on Wednesday. Thanks very much, Patrick, for joining us.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye-bye.